Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to The How of Business with Henry Lopez and David Begin, the podcast that helps you start, run, and grow your small business. And now, here are your hosts.
This is Henry Lopez. Welcome to this episode of The How of Business. My guest today is Liam Martin. Liam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to have you on the show. Liam is an entrepreneur, and he's going to share with us his journey to where how he got to today, where he is today, rather. And then we're going to focus on this concept that he's an expert in, which is in building a remote small business. If you want to receive more information about the How of Business, including links to the show notes page for this episode and other episodes, just text the word biz, B-I-Z, to 31996. So Liam Martin is a serial entrepreneur, a speaker, a writer, and the co-founder of several companies, including Time Doctor, Staff.com, and one of his latest ventures, Running Remote. Liam is an expert, as I said, in the remote business model. And so we're going to chat today about that and get some of his insights for you to consider as a business model for the either your current business that you're expanding or your next business. Let me tell you a little bit about his previous businesses. He still has these businesses. Time Doctor, they offer time tracking solutions for remote and co-located teams. Staff.com is an outsourcing company that concentrates on providing companies with long-term outsource labor relations. You can start to see the theme here, obviously, in these businesses. And Running Remote, which is the world's largest conference on building and scaling remote teams. And there's an event, the second event coming up. The first one was highly successful last year. We're recording this in 2019. And so that's in June 29th through the 30th of 2019. And of all dull places, Bali, Indonesia. So that alone is worth considering it. But we're going to chat about what Running Remote is, what this event is all about. Liam lives, although he travels all over the place, he lives in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And so once again, Liam Martin, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I was listening to your speaker breakdown. It's very interesting when you kind of hear your life in a paragraph.
I know. I hear it.
Yeah, I think when you talked about the vein of what we're doing, it really boils down to mission statement and having mission-based entrepreneurship. So you could call it kind of social entrepreneurship. Some people call it that. We just call it mission-based. So our mission statement as a company that feeds through Time Doctor, Staff, and Running Remote is we want to empower people to be able to work wherever they want, whenever they want. So if we can facilitate that and give people the opportunity to be able to have that capability, we feel that that's going to make for a better world. And that is why we can do things like sell software on one end and then have a conference in Bali on the other, because they all serve that same goal.
When did that vision or mission crystallize for you personally?
After we made enough money that it didn't matter. So
early on, it really wasn't yet in your mindset that I want to build a business that gives me the freedom of location, or was that an early desire?
It was definitely an early desire. So I started probably in entrepreneurship around, actually a little bit earlier than that, but remote work at around the age of 26. I'm 36 now. And if my 26-year-old self heard what I'm going to tell you right now, they would say I'm full of bull. But it really, when you get, and probably a lot of people that are listening to your podcast right now are probably saying, oh, Liam's full of it. But when you get to a certain amount in which you've got enough money that you can take care of yourself. You can take care of the family, the people that you care about. You are a happy and content person, which you probably should have been before you went into this entire endeavor. But if you get out of that end, then it's all about, well, let's do something that's more important than just putting an extra zero in your bank account. And that's what I think, and ironically, actually, once you start thinking in that way, you put a lot more extra zeros in your bank account because you're focused on, you can feel the genuine interaction that people have that are just saying, I'm interacting with you to just put more zeros in my bank account or to get ahead of everyone else versus I'm mission driven. This is what I'm trying to do. If I made no money at this, but I was able to facilitate that goal and I was able to bring that, what my dream of people being able to work wherever they want, whenever they want, all over the world, that would make me a much happier person. And I genuinely would do it without getting paid. Mm-hmm. So,
but of course, you know, the challenge is the 26-year-old had other motivations, right?
He needs to pay his bills.
He needs to pay his bills. Yeah.
He's just out of grad school. He's kind of broke. Yeah. But then I wish I had learned that when I was 26, because if I had moved forward from that mindset, it would have enabled me to be a lot more successful a lot sooner.
Yeah.
And the reason why I wanted to kind of address that is because I bet you the majority of people that are listening to the podcast right now think he's full of bull, but I just, once you guys will get there, whatever there is for you, I hope that you come back to this podcast and say to yourself, oh man, Liam was right.
Yeah, no, I hear you. But you studied sociology nonetheless, and then you went the teaching route initially. I think the first business was a tutoring business. So back when you were getting all that education, what did you think you would be when you were 36?
Oh, I thought I would be, I'd probably just be getting tenure at this point.
Yeah, we're fighting for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So the plan was to be a professor of sociology. That was the plan. My mother really wanted a PhD in the family, so I was on that track. Went to grad school at McGill University, which was one of the best schools that I could afford as a Canadian. And I realized that I needed to come out as an entrepreneur. So I had actually done some entrepreneurial work before going to grad school. I actually sold a small business before going to grad school to fund grad school.
And what business was that? Was that related to Skate Armor or was that something else?
That was actually related to Skate Armor, which was I wouldn't even call it e-commerce. I literally, this was before e-commerce. This was before the days of Amazon, where you would just literally call up companies and you would say, I would like to put my skating goods inside of my sporting goods inside of your store. And I was literally smiling and dialing and building that business. And I sold that to another company in order to facilitate my grad school goals. And I mean, I remember just being so focused on academia. And I remember I was teaching a class. This was the first time that I got to teach a class, which was very exciting for me. I'd been a TA for about 5 years, but this is the first time they were giving me a class. And I had 300 students, first year sociology course. By the end of the year, I had a little over half left, less than 200 left, and I got some of the worst reviews in the entire history of the department for my teaching. And I remember walking into my supervisor's office and I said, I don't think I'm very good at this. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, okay, so what should I do? And he said, well, you know, if you want to continue on with the academia route, you really got to do this teaching thing for the next 10 to 20 years before you get to do anything that's fun. So either figure out how to teach better or lecture, more specifically lecture better, or figure out something else. And so about 8 weeks later, I threw a master's thesis under his door and was let free with a master's degree. And I realized from that, that I really enjoyed teaching, but I did not enjoy lecturing. So I did not enjoy the way that we are communicating information to students, particularly in the post-secondary sense, today. Mm-hmm. It's not a very independent way of learning, and it's a very slow way of learning, unfortunately. But I did recognize that I liked teaching quite a bit. So that actually turned into the tutoring business that I had. And that was the real first remote first business. So I was literally tutoring kids through Skype. And we specialized in pre-med courses. So people will pay exorbitant amounts of money to be able to make sure that they have a 4.0 on their pre-med prerequisites, because that denotes whether or not they get accepted to a really high-end medical school or middle tier medical school. So did that and realized one of the biggest barriers inside of that business was trying to quantify exactly how many hours a tutor worked for a student, because we had dozens of tutors throughout North America and Europe. And I would constantly have students that would email me saying, I did not work with this tutor for 10 hours. I worked with them for 5 hours. So then I'd have to go to the tutor and say, hey, did you work with Jimmy for 10 hours? And the tutor would say, of course I did. So then what do I do? Well, I have to refund Jimmy for 5 hours and I have to pay out the tutor for the full 10 hours. And I ended up losing money at the deal. And this was creating a serious problem inside of the business because I could not quantify precisely how many hours were worked, and there was no independent tracking solution that I could implement to be able to solve this problem. And Time Doctor basically solved that problem for me. I went to, ironically, while we were recording this, South by Southwest in Austin, Texas is happening,
right,
which is basically, it is spring break for nerds, right? I think, have you ever been to South by Southwest before?
I've been around it, but I've never dared to go because it's too much chaos and too many people for me. I know what it is, obviously, but I have not been.
Yeah, I'm not going this year, but I've been maybe 8 or 9 years in a row. And it is like spring break for nerds. It's a great experience if you're a tech guy like me and you want to just nerd out with other nerds and feel important, more importantly. It's one of the only environments in which South By is one of those environments where nerds actually are cool,
right?
Which is great. So I met my co-founder there and he had an early alpha of a tool called Time Doctor. And he was trying to solve the exact problem that I had inside of my tutoring business.
Now, was that coincidental that you connected with this person?
Completely coincidental. Was connected through a mutual friend who actually is now an advisor to the company, specifically because she connected the two of us. But purely coincidental. I think the universe has a very interesting way of presenting you options at the right time. So I said,
hey, and when you put yourself in a position to have those coincidental situations, right?
Absolutely.
Because if you wouldn't have been a person who put yourself out there and had not gone to an event like that where other like-minded people were, it might not have happened.
Yes. And my other philosophy toward this is, if you really want to figure out how to work on something, put yourself right in the middle of the people that are currently doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was doing with South by Southwest. And I think that for anyone that's listening right now that is saying, oh, well, I don't have a network or I can't access. I mean, number one, listening to podcasts like this is a fantastic way to be able to just pull that information into your mind. You know, these people that are out in a town of 2,000 people, as an example, you can still get access to this type of, these types of thoughts by listening to podcasts, but then also making the commitment to say, I'm going to go to maybe 1 to 2 conferences per year where I can put myself in the middle of that conversation with like-minded people is incredibly powerful for changing your mind. So reorganizing the way that you think and what is possible and it is not possible, but then secondarily actually having these connections and possibly building new businesses from them.
Yeah. Great tip. All right. So did the tutoring business then fade out at some point?
Yeah, I actually, it's kind of a bad story. I got acquired by a company for parts. I was way too naive, and a company that was wanting to get into the remote tutoring space, that was a huge brick and mortar tutoring space, asked me to, they wanted to talk to me about online tutoring. And I was more than happy to be able to tell them my entire business model and everything that it worked. And then 6 months later, they came out with a competitive product, and they could do it because they just owned the brick and mortar space.
Sure.
And they said, well, you know, you could always just sell that to us. But here's the multiple that we'll accept. And I was at a point at that point where the business was doing six figures. I can't remember exactly where we actually ended off. It was to the point in which I had a good salary coming in, but I actually was making a lot more on consulting for remote teams.
I see.
Because I was one of the first people doing that. So sure. That was, I just kind of realized, okay, it's time to move on and
So when the tutoring business ends, now you are officially out of the education business. What did your mom think about that at that point?
Oh, she wasn't super impressed that I didn't do the PhD. I think she still kind of asks now. She's like, oh, well, you know, maybe you should go back to grad school. And that's honestly never going to happen. I think that, and for anyone that's listening again that is in graduate school, I think that you should finish what you started. But I am not very convinced that the current system that we have in place right now is the right direction to go for anyone that's entrepreneurial, that has an entrepreneurial spark. Right. And I think that you need to recognize that. I think that the majority of that form of education is probably through mentorship. So if you're an entrepreneur or you want to be an entrepreneur, what I suggest to people is go and work for a company that has venture funding and has less than 10 employees. And you will learn everything that you possibly need to learn about being an entrepreneur. You will be the CEO and founder. You will do all of their jobs. And you can do that for a year or two and in essence get an MBA right then and there.
Yeah, I have to agree. All right, so then what leads to launching staff.com?
So that was an interesting opportunity that popped up for us, which was as we were building out Time Doctor as a beta product, a lot of the other job platforms for remote work started contacting us and were interested in acquisition before we went public, before we actually started selling. So the technology at that point was, there was a new innovation that we had implemented that no one else had been able to implement, which was we not only measured how long someone was working, but we measured all of the metadata behind that activity. So we, in essence, measure websites, applications, mouse movements, and keyboard movements, which are proprietary to the individual. However, from that, you can create insights and be able to create predictions from that data. Mm-hmm. So as an example, we can predict with about an 89% accuracy rate whether someone will quit their job about 6 months before they do. Mm-hmm. So this was very interesting and useful to these other platforms. And we looked at these other platforms, and they were all doing small task and project work. And for us, we have, at this point, about a little under 100 people in 28 different countries all over the world. And none of them are working on little projects. They're all long-term working relationships. And we feel that that is a better way to be able to move forward on the future of work. I don't think that the future of work is the gig economy, or at least I'm trying to actively combat that because I feel that it is a environment in which you can never really be mission focused. If you're constantly doing Uber rides or building small little logos for people, there's no mission behind that. And people just aren't not going to get very passionate about that particular type of project. But everyone that works for us, I mean, the first thing that we do every time that we have a monthly meeting is we review what the mission statement of the company is and why we're here. And why we're doing this, and we're doing this not necessarily for a paycheck, but for something higher. So,
on this point, Liam, if I can interrupt on the whole gig economy, that's sparked some curiosity there. That do you think though there's a happy medium, especially for the younger generations, in something that's a little longer than a short gig, but not necessarily, I'm not going to give you 10 years of my career. I want to work on a project that has meaning and has that I can really contribute to. And then I'm speaking as that potential employee or remote employee. And then I'll reevaluate and decide if I stay or if I go on to the next challenge. Does that make sense as well? Productive?
That's basically our model at this point, where you can work for So we'll kind of have like what we'll call a dating period for our HR process, where we'll work with someone for about a month. And then if they get past that month, then we work with them for another 3 months.
And you do that first month as a contractor, don't you?
Yes. So it's all on. So the actual logistics of contractor relationships, it is a logistical nightmare to be able to set up corporations in 28 different countries all over the world. Right. So for the purposes of a legal framework, they're all contractors. However, they do work for us for the majority of their time, and we give them a lot of the advantages that you would give to an employee. So what we mean by that is, you know, they get a month off. They have other advantages, like they purchase their own equipment because contractors are required to purchase their own equipment under those types of rules. But there's a lot of other things that, like, we do a team retreat every year. So we fly everyone in the company down to one single location for about a week, and we work together to be able to unify us and make sure that we're all moving in the same direction. Those types of things you wouldn't necessarily get in a gig economy, but you do get in longer term remote work relationships.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, I'm going to hold off on doing a deeper dive on running remote, because we're going to get into it as we dive into the topic, and then we'll definitely summarize with it. One of the questions I have before we move into specifically talking about remote small business is, you now have several businesses. How do you manage handling all of them and, you know, putting your proper focus where it needs to be? I'm sure if some of it is partners, but how do you manage these multiple businesses now?
I'm going to give you a very simplistic answer, which is not the complete answer, but delegation and process documentation are probably, if I had to boil it down to those two major variables, it's those two. So process documentation was something that I understood very early on. It's the major differentiator between a remote first company, which I think we can kind of get into a little bit later, company, and then what we call an on-premise company. For anyone that's dealing in tech, on-premise means when you used to put your server rack, you used to put software on servers directly inside of that office. So we call them on-premise companies because they're old and crappy. And that's what we kind of think of the old business model of putting employees in offices seems like a bad idea when you can hire from the global market. So we have, so process documentation is basically the idea that if someone is in an office, so if you were sitting right next to me and you were a new employee, I can see what you're doing and I can show you how to do it correctly or incorrectly very quickly right there. But when someone is 10,000 miles away, you don't have that type of interaction. So what you need to do to overcome that is to be able to build out process documentation, which means building out a whole bunch of operational procedures, SOPs, digitizing them, and then being able to have them very easily, communicate them very easily to other people inside of your organization. And so that's probably been the biggest singular thing that has helped us develop out these remote businesses and business in general. Most Fortune 500s are entirely built on SOPs because they're forced to because they have 1,000 people, 10,000 people in their organization.
Right.
Remote businesses have to act like big businesses, and you would think that that is a little frustrating at the beginning, but long term that actually is a great win for you, because if you have 20 people and you have all your procedures in place, there's nothing stopping you from going to 200 very quickly and easily. Whereas if you were in a on-premise business inside of an office, you would have to really continuously train those people with the people that are currently in that office. And that creates a drag on that business, which you just don't have inside of remote businesses. Yeah. And then go ahead.
Well, it's such a huge takeaway though, Liam, because I think the other thing that it highlights is for on-premise businesses, and we'll get to it in a moment, but there are some businesses where that's the model that might make best sense, right? If you're offering a brick and mortar product or service, for example. But nonetheless, the problem is that we use that because you don't have in a remote-based business, you have to have these things in place or it's going to fail. we lean on the excuse that, well, you know, just go over there and ask Henry and he knows how to do that, right? And we never then document our procedures and our systems. And that's why even small business, even small on-premise businesses end up getting bogged down because they haven't invested the time in doing that.
Absolutely. And they can, the problem is they can sell that problem down the river till later.
That's right.
But with you can put that remote off. Business, you can't.
Right, good point.
Actually, it's a forcing function to say, right. Well, Johnny doesn't know what the heck is going on. Johnny is in Kiev right now.
Yeah, he's asleep right now.
He can't figure out what the heck to do. So you got to build the operational procedures in place to tell Johnny how to end his signature, as an example, in an email. I can tell you one perfect example of a story where we just didn't have an SOP for what you would put in an email signature. And we had one of our customer support reps who is Roman Catholic and would put in Bible quotes in her signature. And we had an atheist who was a customer who just took a strip off of us saying, how dare you put this type of stuff in front of me? And I have no inclinations, religious or non-religious, with regards to how you live your life. But for us, we just recognized, well, we should probably have a procedure, you know, a standard operating procedure for what you can put in these signatures and you can't put in these signatures.
Sure.
Yeah. Maybe all of our signatures should all sync up. Yeah. Right? Like, those are the small examples of things that can just go wrong.
Right.
And you need to be able to have those procedures in place. But you can sell that down the river, because if you're all in the same office, you could just say, hey, Maureen put in a bad signature. Everybody, make sure that you're signing your documents like this, your emails like this. But in a digital business, you can't do that.
This is Henry Lopez. Let's take a quick pause on this episode to chat about your small business dreams. Do you have a great business idea, but have just not been able to get it launched? Have you built a successful corporate career, but need some help making the transition to entrepreneurship? Are you ready to start building your own wealth instead of someone else's? I invite you to schedule a free business coaching consultation with me. Just text BizCoach, all together, BizCoach, to 31996 for more information. I welcome the opportunity to chat with you about your business dreams and goals and offer the guidance and accountability that we all need to launch our first business. As an experienced entrepreneur who also made the difficult transition from the corporate world, I understand the challenges you're facing, and often it's about helping you ask the right questions so that you can make progress towards achieving your goals. I can help you through your transition to becoming your own boss. To find out more or to schedule your free coaching session, just text BizCoach to 31996 now. That's BizCoach, BizCoach, to 31996, or visit thehowofbusiness.com. All right, so why, as we segue then into diving deeper into building a remote business, why, I guess it's a two-part question. When did it switch for you, right? Because the tutoring business, I guess maybe that was somewhat remote, but when did it crystallize for you, and when did you decide this is the model for me?
I think it was when we built Time Doctor, because we were very specifically facilitating a tool to target that specific market.
Sure.
Before that point, with the online tutoring company, which was remote as well, it was very rare. It was 10 years ago. 11 years ago. And it was one of those things that people still thought it was pretty weird. Like Skype kind of worked. Skype wouldn't actually work in a lot of different markets because we just didn't have the fiber infrastructure that we currently have right now. Like we're chatting on Zoom and we could do a 4K Zoom meeting, probably do five of them and have no lag. 10 years ago, that just wasn't possible. So the technology also had to speed up, but I recognized at that point that the ability to be able to facilitate labor from anywhere on planet Earth, to be able to not hire the best developer for $10,000 a month in San Francisco, but to hire the best developer for $10,000 a month on planet Earth, gave me such a huge strategic advantage in the market that if I didn't continue doing this, I would recognize that I'd be left behind. And yeah. It was interesting. My estimates were probably about 5 years and this would work. And I was off by about 5 years. So now we're really getting into remote work, entering the kind of generalized market, which is...
Meaning it took 5 years longer than you thought it would?
Yeah. So I thought probably by approximately the... I thought that by 2010, we were going to see what's currently happening in 2019, probably, if I'm going to be completely honest.
Connectivity infrastructure was one of the obstacles. What else?
The tools. So we all have our remote technology stacks. So we have Slack, we have tools like Zoom, Basecamp, Trello, Time Doctor as one of those pieces inside of the technology stack that allow not only the facilitation of remote collaboration, but remote work, the documentation of remote work, the payment networks that you need to be able to pay someone in Nigeria, as an example, way back in the day, and I'm never going to enter Ukraine any longer, so it isn't a problem if I tell this story, but we would literally sneak money, US dollars, into Ukraine because there was no other way to be able to pay people.
Yeah.
And you could get a developer that would be as good as a San Francisco developer, someone with two PhDs, like ex-Iron Curtain, PhDs in computer science, who's an absolute genius, and you'd be able to get that person for maybe a third to a quarter of the costing in San Francisco. And that ratio, in essence, still is happening right now. For anyone that's really interested in kind of getting fantastic labor opportunities, Eastern Europe is probably one of the best places to be able to hire developers right now per dollar. Yeah. And so these opportunities are starting to pop up, but they only really started to become mainstream once we had the technological infrastructure in the back end to be able to facilitate it, which we have now.
That makes sense. Okay, so obviously something like a software company, which is the businesses that you started developing, and I've got a little bit of experience there, that's a good fit. What other types of businesses do you think are a good fit for this, as you call the remote first business model? Or I may have added the model part of it, but what are some other types of businesses that this is a good fit for in your experience?
So you can pull off departments, and then you can also have remote first. So we have, we kind of boil down remote first into two separate categories. There's, if you're a remote first business, which means you're trying to hire remote as a first kind of option before you hire local, or open up an office somewhere, because the costing of just running that office is so high. Let's say it's the same exact salary. You're probably paying an extra 30 cents on every dollar of labor that you're facilitating.
Now, one of the caveats has to be that that person, it's hard for that person to be someone who delivers, let's say, customer facing services.
Absolutely.
In a time zone, right? So that's one caveat, right?
Yes. So if you can't do it from a computer, so plumbers will never be remote.
Sure.
I mean, actually, you probably could have a system where you would facilitate, you'd have a computer turn on and you'd have a guy pop up as a plumber and say, and then you point it at the pipe and say, hey, what's going on here? And he would probably be able to.
If some of medicine is going that way, we can definitely do it in the plumbing business.
That's it. So I think that, however, those are probably less applicable.
Sure.
Any thought work, so anything that's done on a computer can in essence be digitized, be remote. Yeah. So that boils down to, I mean, customer support, customer success, sales to a degree, development, obviously, marketing, obviously. But there are a lot of, I mean, even now, when you look at the model that we have with Amazon, which is in essence a remote Walmart, right? When you really kind of boil it down to you being able to push a button and get toilet paper in under an hour from Prime, that's another component of remote that I think is probably going to you could add into under that umbrella. However, the person in the warehouse obviously is not going to be able to be remote. That person will always have to put that product in the bucket. So when we look at the estimates of that labor market size, we're talking probably about half of the United States is doing thought work and then that can be made remote. So I probably would say the top end of that model would probably be 40 to 50% of all labor being remote. Currently, right now, in 2017, it was 2.1% of all labor in the United States. And it is currently, and the data hasn't come in yet completely, but I believe it's around 3.94% right now in 2018 numbers. So we're getting to a point where we're almost kind of on an exponential escape curve trajectory. But I think that we're probably going to see something like 6-7% next year, 2019, this year. So once we get past 10%, I think you're going to see a huge shift. One out of 10 workers are working their entire workday from a computer. Will be huge. Right now as well, about 54% of all labor in the United States works remote to some degree. So they'll have like remote work Fridays as an example.
What will be interesting is, of course, and I'm sure you've given this a lot of thought, I don't necessarily want to go too far off on this tangent, but is the impact then on American employees, right, on the American labor force. If I'm, just to talk about an example, for example, if I'm a young developer, you know, a few years out of school, and I have the skills that you're looking for that kind of position, are you looking to hire remote first in other countries in part because of the price point that you're getting for the skill?
Absolutely. In part, there's always going to be those components inside of the market. I think what's going to happen is the market will become a lot more competitive. And I think you will have a situation in which, regardless of where you are or what connections you have, you will get access to labor in a much more egalitarian way than you did before. So just because you went to Harvard doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the job. It's, can you actually execute on the work that's being done? And I think for a lot of people that are getting passed on their laurels at this point, life is going to change pretty significantly. Mm-hmm. And I think that I actually think you're going to see a rise of the Midwest that you probably have never seen before. I actually think what's going to happen, and you're already seeing this to a degree, and this also connects to artificial intelligence and a lot of automation that we're currently experiencing right now. We're in the vestiges of kind of entering that new age of AI. You're going to see people move out of the major cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and you're going to see them move into a lot more cost-efficient areas that will make them a lot happier. So I think you're actually going to see the resurgence of like the small town.
It's interesting because that's not been what the data has been telling us, right? We've been going through this period of time where people have been moving back into urban areas.
Yes.
But and you're seeing that in part is going to be driven by, if I can't find a job here, I got to do something else, right?
Well, and maybe I do have a job, but my job is on a computer. Mm-hmm. And why am I paying... I have a friend of mine that just moved to London and he's paying £5,000 a month for a 2-bedroom apartment, which is like,
I don't know. Right, but the reason I'm paying it is I want the community. I want all of the other things that entertain me and that I can be part of.
Absolutely.
Urban area as opposed to in the middle of Montana somewhere. Not that there's anything wrong with Montana, but you understand what I'm saying. But
yes,
that's what absolutely. You're seeing in part. But I thought where you were going to go was that now I have as a potential service provider and employee, a lower cost structure that then might reflect itself into being able to better compete for those positions against someone from somewhere else that has a lower cost structure?
Yes. And also too, you're probably going to see the, I think probably what's going to happen is it's going to be a lot more competitive job market, particularly for thought workers. And I don't know whether it's going to come from workers that are located outside of the United States, as an example, in second and third world countries, or if it's going to directly come from artificial intelligence, which is something that maybe we shouldn't necessarily get into.
Exactly.
But it's one of those things that I have a friend of mine who is a lawyer that was working in Manhattan and got replaced by an AI because they can the AI can do legal work better than he can.
Yeah.
So you've got these two forces that are pushing on you, but I would see his services as an example, just to boil down to this lawyer. He's incredibly gifted as a lawyer, and he can work out of Montana, as an example. He can pull in $100,000 instead of $250,000, but his cost of living is now $20,000 instead of $200,000.
That's right. Yeah, and that's what I was getting at.
And I think that's the future.
Yeah, I hear you. So compelling and fascinating stuff. All right, we've talked about a little bit about the types of businesses it might be a fit for, and then we've just now really been talking about my next question, which is the type of person that the remote first model is best suited for. But I want to look at it from both perspectives. We've been kind of been talking about it from the potential employee of one of these companies, but from a business owner, from a founder, as you saw yourself evolve and you talk to other people, what are some of the characteristics that I have to have as a business owner or a potential business owner to go down this road?
Well, I think the first thing that you have to be able, we do a lot of psychometric testing of employees and employers by extension. And we found on both sides that individuals that are more introverted as opposed to extroverted usually have an easier time with remote work models than with on-premise models, with office models. And the reason being is some people get energy from talking to other people, and other people, it sucks energy from them. Mm-hmm. I can give you an example. One of the product managers inside of our company is three blocks away from where I currently am right now. I maybe talk to this guy once a month face-to-face. No, once a quarter face-to-face. But yet I meet him virtually 3 to 4 times a week. Mm-hmm. And he just does not like meeting people in person. He finds that as a draw on his energy. And instead, he likes to work from home. He's got a fantastic work setup. And that's the way that he lives his life. So introversion is probably a good facilitator as opposed to extroversion. And then for me, I think once you truly understand that you can work remotely and you can build the business just as quickly, the other advantage is people that would like to travel. So I was in Mexico for the winter. I am now back for a couple weeks here in Canada. And then I'm going to Egypt for the month of April. And then I'm going on to Bali for the month of May and June. And then I'm coming back to Ottawa for July and August because the summers in Canada are beautiful. So I really do live probably about 6 months away from my home base. And I'm very comfortable with that. And it just adds an extra layer of enjoyment to my life that I wouldn't have otherwise had.
Yeah. Now that's got to be such a key component of it. I think if that's one of the primary things you're looking to get out of being an entrepreneur is that freedom of location, then this remote model makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, my definition of entrepreneurship is the ability to do whatever you want with whoever you want, wherever you want, for as long as you want, and add a bunch of others onto mm-hmm. that. Like you just do what you want to do. I have no decision now, or I have very few decisions in my day. I guess I got to do that. Everything is I get to talk on this podcast. This is exciting for me. That's entrepreneurship. At least I guess, suppose, successful entrepreneurship. There's a lot of grinding that you have to do beforehand before you can get to that point. But once you're there, it's a very exciting place to be. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't work. You know, I don't want to say that I work some type of a beach life 4 hours a week, as an example. I am someone who works, well, I can tell you very specifically, I worked about 53 hours last week mm-hmm. on my computer, but I liked every minute of it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. So that's what you really want to get to.
Yeah. And what I love about it is when you have the opportunity and flexibility, and like you said, you work towards it to work from different places. I find that it motivates me so much. I mean, I really get re-energized and reinvigorated, and it almost motivates me. I want to work that much more, or smarter, but work that much more because I want to keep that flexibility that I have.
Absolutely. I was working in Playa del Carmen on the Riviera Maya coast in Mexico for about 2 months. And I was working from about 9 to 6 p.m. at a co-working space down there. And afterwards, I was able to walk out on the 5th Street, which is a huge active street in that small city, and have cheap tacos and hang out with interesting people. And just my life was so much more enriched being able to live in that environment for 2 months. And now I can come back to where I originally live, or where I basically hang my hat, where I have my lease. And I think that it's such an empowering thing, not just for my own personal well-being, but also just making me a more interesting, multifaceted person.
No, I was saying, on the flip side, then, of course, the obvious is you get then people to work with you on your teams, your employees, your contractors, that have that equal motivation. They're happy, and so they're producing more and better, I have to believe.
Yeah, I had a sales guy that was in Canada, and he just recently, he moved to Medellin, Colombia for a few weeks. First time that he was ever working remotely, because we were encouraging him to say, if you would like to move, it's totally up to you, and we will help you facilitate any type of move that you would like. And then he came back to Canada for about 2 weeks, and now he's doing 4 months in Medellin. He's gone back. And he really enjoys that. And he's 24. So he's just kind of, his eyes have opened to these new opportunities. And he had never traveled outside of North America before that point. So he's going to come back being such a more, I don't want to say interesting, but that's probably the best word that I have for it, because he'll have these new life experiences.
And engage, you know, you touched earlier about those psychographics, I think was the term, that you start to collect as indicators to when someone is ready to leave. And I got to believe that these kind of things are those new challenges, those refreshing events that keep a staff member engaged.
Well, working remotely or a remote work agreement is the number one perk for millennials. That's their number one most requested perk, is remote work agreements. So not only is it something that will keep people inside of your company for longer and your retention will stay high, more importantly, it's something that you will have to include in the very near future, or you will not be able to get people under 35 that will want to work for you, because they'll work for someone else. That top talent will go other places.
Yeah. All right. Give me two or three of your top tools, technical tools, that help you manage your business remotely.
So outside of Time Doctor, which is absolutely the best and most amazing tool that you can possibly think of for managing remote teams, that plug wasn't too direct. I
love it.
Think probably the next couple top ones for us would be Skype, Slack, Basecamp, and some honorable mentions would be Jira and InVision. So I can go through those very quickly.
Well,
so,
I want to focus on Slack and Basecamp because I get confused sometimes on what do I use one versus the other for.
Okay, so Basecamp is for projects and Slack is for communication. So I have a very small message like, hey, Henry, I need you to, here's that image that I promised you. I would put that in Slack, where it's maybe too short of a message to throw inside of an email. And I just want to be able to communicate it to you very quickly and synchronously, as opposed to asynchronously. So it's an app that you can push and get a beep anywhere, and you can get that level of distraction, which is another conversation. There's a competitive app that is on an asynchronous model, which a lot of studies have shown is actually a lot more successful for productive work. It's called Twist, which you might want to check out as well for remote teams. Okay. And then Basecamp, and even other, you can throw in a whole bunch of other project management tools under that umbrella, are more for longer term discussion. So if you want to have large scale collaboration on what is a new feature that we should add inside of Time Doctor, and here's some survey data, and here's what our top 10 customers are saying, and I'm going to collaborate with, let's say, 10 or 20 people, Basecamp would probably be the best place to be able to facilitate that, because the chat log is very easily, the message log is very easy to communicate through, and then you can create tasks from that information to basically form a plan that you would throw into something like InVision or Jira as an example.
All right, good clarification there. All right, I think what makes sense now, because I want to start bringing this to an end here, we can keep going for a couple of hours if I allow us to do so, which is great, we're going to have you back on. But I think what would make sense is tell us about Running Remote and what that's all about and the upcoming event.
Sure. So I want to be very clear with people, and it again connects to mission statement. If you don't have a remote team or you're not a remote leader, what I kind of call like an intrapreneur inside of a remote company or one that wants to become remote, the conference is probably not for you.
Fair.
So it's where we're assembling the top thought leaders and operators inside of remote companies and basically just building a playbook on how to build and scale remote teams. We had about 2 years ago, we were sitting down and trying to figure out how we get to 200 remote employees. I think we had about 70, 80 people at that point. And there was nothing. We were looking at blog posts. We were trying to look at videos and just, there was a whole bunch of information on how to hire a virtual assistant or how to hire your first remote employee, but there was nothing at scale. And we said to ourselves, well, we're actually a business model, Time Doctor more specifically, that we make more money for every new employee that's added inside of our account. But there's no information to connect people to really build and scale out those teams. And it's something that we're really looking for. So we said to ourselves, let's actually just do it. It was really scary. It was kind of like a
can imagine.
Ready, fire, aim situation where we just cut a check for $100,000 to be able to run the conference instead of people show up, they show up. And thankfully we had a sold out house. We had almost 300 people go to the first one. We're planning on having 500 to this next one.
Where was it last year?
It was in Ubud, which is still in Bali, but it's in the center of the island. Now we're doing it down by the beach because people wanted
to. So, you know, the location you've chosen was quite ostentatious. I mean, that has to have taken some guts because on top of it was the first time last year, that is, to then make it at such a remote location. What was your thinking there? Because that was pretty brave.
So two things. Number one, Ubud and Bali in general is a remote work hub. So people see it as where remote workers just go and live a very cheap, luxurious lifestyle. So there is a community there. And then secondarily, it was a way to make sure that we had the best people in the room that were really passionate about building and scaling remote teams. So we have set the price point higher than most other conferences. Our ticket prices are, the top end pricing is $1,000. To be able to go to the conference, there are lower cost tickets right now before the last couple months. But we set such a high price point because we wanted, number one, that to be a barrier to entry for people. And then secondarily, you have to fly to Bali, which is another barrier to entry, so that
Sure.
you have the right people in the room and people that are really excited and passionate about doing this are the ones that are going to come. We may have it at a much more commercial location in the future, but for right now, we want the best people in the room. And we kind of feel I've gotten a lot of leadership and mentorship with regards to conferences. And the two things that you have to do is make sure that you have great speakers, and then make sure that you have great attendees and make sure the place doesn't burn down. Those two things, and you can run a great conference. But if any of those three things are missing, you just don't have that same magic. So it was purposeful.
I love it. It's bold. I think it also signals, I mean, Bali is when people think about, they dream out, I'd love to be a person that has the flexibility to work from Bali, right? So I think it also tapped into that to an extent.
Absolutely.
All right. We'll start to wrap it up. Books. I'm always looking for a book recommendation. What would you suggest?
So on theory, I would probably go with 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. And that just kind of teaches you the theory of building and scaling, particularly tech companies, but I think it can apply to any particular company. He has these great concepts talking about only getting into a market unless you can have your product is exponentially cheaper or exponentially better. And the mindset that he gives you, I think, is a really interesting way to approach business. And obviously, he was incredibly successful, co-founder of PayPal. He's built Palantir, all multi-billion dollar companies. And the second one, after you read that one, would be The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. I'm a little bit biased towards the tech side of it, but Lean Startup just really gives you the framework to be able to say, I have this theoretical idea for something that could be 10 times cheaper inside of the HR space. Now, Eric Ries teaches you how to actually get that product to market as cheaply as humanly possible so that you can continuously iterate and make sure that you have something that really speaks to that market.
Wonderful. Great recommendations. We'll have links to both of those books in the show notes page at thehowabusiness.com. The whole lean startup thing, I'm completely convinced that that philosophy, that iterative philosophy, I can apply it to just about every kind of business, even a brick and mortar business, even like a restaurant. You could start with a pop-up. You could start in a commercial kitchen. You could start with a food truck. I think it's the way to go for just about any kind of business.
Absolutely. I had an interesting story connected to him where we were spending a ton of money on building a project management feature inside of Time Doctor. And we spent that money and we were not getting people to actually engage with the feature at all. And they were paying customers. And we had it inside of our dashboard. And Eric Reese suggested to us, he's like, well, here's what you should do. You should just take it off your dashboard. And I said, what do you mean? Like, I don't want to delete all that code. He's like, no, don't delete any code. Just take the link off your dashboard and see how much hate mail you get. Mm-hmm. And that will, and in reality, what you really should have done is not built the feature at all. Just put that link on your dashboard. And then when people click on it saying, hey, you just voted to have a project management feature on Time Doctor, what would it look like to you? And would you be willing to pay more money for it? That's the lean startup philosophy, which I think is incredibly easy to be able to implement. And it just allows you to move so much faster, but you got to get it in your head.
Yeah, that's great. All right, let's wrap it up. What's one thing you want to stick away from this conversation? It's been a broad-ranging conversation, which has been fantastic. I think maybe from the perspective of that person who's looking to start a business and is leaning towards going the remote first route, what's the key takeaway for that person?
I think I'm going to give you a warning, which is remote work is not just an employee perk. I think it is going to be the next option for most of the young people that are currently in the market today. And if you don't have that in place, you're not going to be taking advantage of that component of the labor force, which I think is probably the component of the labor force that you need to get access to. So implementing that, and it's very easy to build a remote work relationship, agreement, deploy that, and then just see what happens and see the quality of people that you get.
Yeah. So even if it's a department-based, I think was the terminology used, that's something I need to be exploring, especially in those areas and those fields where that's where it's going.
Everyone's scared. The biggest fear with remote work for people that are in on-premise businesses right now that own them are saying, I don't know what these people are doing.
Yeah.
When they're working from home, I don't know what they're doing. Time Doctor can completely solve that problem. If you want to use it, there are other tools that you can implement to be able to solve that problem as well. So I think you just need to even if you don't have any tools at all, testing it is just test that assumption, see whether or not you get what the output is from those remote workers. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Agreed. Where do you want us to go online to learn more?
I think the best place is YouTube. Go to youtube.com/runningremote. We have all of our talks up there. And we also have a whole bunch of other information connected to remote work and how to build remote teams. And if you put a comment down there, I will get back to you within 12 hours.
Love it. Yeah. I spent a lot of time there doing the research for this conversation. There's a lot of good content there.
Yeah. It's my new
Liam, topic. This is good. Fantastic. Yeah. Right. And we can go off on an hour on that, what a great method that is to create content, even in the context of a remote team. Mm-hmm. I think you talked about it in another podcast. That's your preferred communication method is a video, right?
Absolutely. I think it's the most information rich way to communicate what you're doing.
Yeah. All right, Liam, this has been a fantastic conversation. Loved every part of it. Got a lot of great takeaways, and hopefully we can convince you to come back here in a couple months and we'll resume and dive into some of the other areas. Maybe after the conference, that might be a good time to do so. But thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a ton of fun.
This is Henry Lopez, and thanks for listening to this episode of The How of Business. My guest today again was Liam Martin. We release new episodes every Monday morning, and you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and at our website, thehowofbusiness.com. You can also just text the word biz, B-I-Z, to 31996 to receive more information.
Thank you for listening to The How of Business. For more information, links, and other resources, please visit thehowofbusiness.com.